Hello, I'm Michael Dorinda.
And I'm Jake Bennett.
And welcome to episode 153 of the North Meets South Web Podcast.
You did it. We got it. Hey, I'm going to request that we go full on, full intro music from now on.
Someone commented on it last time.
What'd they say?
Someone agreed with you about the full intro song.
I can't remember
who it was.
It's a really good one. And you know what else? I was listening to No Plans to Merge, and they have a really cool intro song, and I love listening to it. It's, you know, that whole little clapping thing. It's really fun.
It's funny when I hear a podcast at like one time, because I listen to all of my podcasts at 2.5 times, because I listen to far too many of them. And so as a result, I listen to them at a high speed, and every now and then I'll hear a podcast, or Ree and I listen to the same podcasts, you know, some of the parenting ones and things like that. And so I will hear her listening to them. I'm going, oh God, is that what they sound like?
Right.
I get that from my boss at work. He's like, oh, it's so weird hearing your voice at one times. Can you talk faster?
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. Can you talk at 1.5 times speed, please? The funny thing is, doesn't it sort of like, you know, it used to be when you'd put like a record, like when you were a kid, when you put a record at like 1.5 speed. Yeah. With some like chipmunk voices, right? And it doesn't do that anymore. It like keeps, it maintains the tone of the voice. It just speeds it up, right? So, it's like this. The tone is the same. It's just it seems like you're talking slow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it was Justin Jackson. I'm going to say it was Justin Jackson.
Okay.
Who agrees with you on the audio?
Well, if it's Justin Jackson, I kind of have to defer to him. He is like
the podcast guy. Yeah,
he is indeed. So we might have to just bring it back. Also, I just want to say, first and foremost, kudos to Mr. Michael Dorinda for editing our podcasts for all of these many years. Thank you so much for doing so. And also, the last Laravel News podcast sounded really freaking good. I was listening to it, and I'm like, this is like the best it sounded in a long time. And I was like, did you do anything special to it? And you're like, I don't know if I did anything special to it, really, but it sounded much better. Anyway, I was just thinking about it. It's like, thanks for editing all those. That's a lot of work. I really, really appreciate it.
Hopefully this one comes out pretty well. I don't know if you saw the other podcast that I did. We interviewed
Ripples. Yeah. Aaron Francis.
Interviewed Aaron Francis, which was a great chat, but I thought, If he's going to try harder, then I need to try harder. And so for that episode, and I will probably do it with this one as well. Not that I don't think anyone watches the video that we've ever published for this episode, but for this show. But I think it was just a bit of fun to. So I'm trying to learn how to use DaVinci Resolve because I've got some marketing stuff that I need to do for Laracon AU coming up. And I thought, well, I may as well use this as an opportunity to kind of learn the tool. So by the time it comes to doing those things, you know, I have a reasonable understanding, but it makes doing multicam editing very simple, and it syncs everything up. So I can just, if I wanted to, we ended up stacking the videos so that we had, you know, side by side and things like that.
But it looked really good. Yeah, it looked solid.
You can, if you want to, essentially go through and like just click the camera that you want to focus on. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit harder in that kind of podcast when people are talking, like there's a conversation rather than just a singular talking head. You know, you don't want to hear in the background some going or you know, the agreement. You kind of want to see that person, I think. But you can, if you're doing lots of switching, just like click camera one, click camera two, and like bounce between them, and it just handles all of it, syncs it all up. And I think I took some of the tips that I learned from Aaron's screencasting.com course in terms of like ducking video or ducking audio under the next video clip and things like that. And I think it made the transitions look a bit nicer. You know, having Aaron nodding whilst someone talks under him in a full frame. And then, so I don't know, it was just a bit of fun to play around with it.
That's pretty cool. We have the, because DaVinci is made by Blackmagic, I think, right? DaVinci Resolve is Blackmagic, right? And so we use a lot of the Blackmagic tools. We have Blackmagic cameras. We have the ATEM Mini Extreme, I think is what it is. Mm-hmm. And so it's like got 8 different inputs. It's got a couple different USB-C outputs, one to a clean webcam. You can customize what they are, but one's like a clean webcam output. The other one goes to like a little storage drive, right? A little USB storage drive. And so it outputs all of the videos in both your, so your display, like whatever you have as your displayed version, but then it also outputs all the raw and the the video feeds individually, right? But I think what you can do after the fact is in DaVinci Resolve, I think you can also hook up the A10 Mini and sort of use that as your switcher. So you can like video one, video two, video three, video four. Mm-hmm. And you can actually find those pretty cheap. They've got some of the older ones on eBay, you know, like they've got an A10 Mini Pro, or they might have just like a smaller one that's just got like three or four inputs, and that actually might be perfect instead of having to click around. And I know you're a tech head, you love all the gear.
Oh, I know. Friend,
so you're already looking
show,
it up probably.
Eric Johnson, show Eric Van Johnson, they bought some Blackmagic equipment to do the live streaming of PHP Tech in previous years, and every time he mentions it on the PHP Ugly podcast, I get up the Blackmagic website. I'm like, oh, I could buy
man, these are all business, you know what,
business expenses now. It would be fun to buy.
We might have an old one. We might have an old one around. I should see.
It's just, I thought I could pick up one of the cameras to use the cameras, like just the cheap single. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I think it was like $900. I thought that's not unreasonable, but it's just the body. Like all of the advertising.
The lenses are way more expensive than the bodies.
All of the advertising on their store and all of the photos show the cameras with the lenses, and they don't like Canon and Sony, they all say body only. Like it's very clear that it's body only. Mm-hmm. It's not until you like really dig into it that you find out, oh no, this is just the body, and you've got to like go and figure out where to buy the camera, the lenses.
Some freaking prime lens, you know?
But having the A10 would be cool, even, you know, if for no other reason than to just be able to do input switching. Like we've got
Riverside, really nice.
This is pretty easy, and like the DaVinci software is really nice, and I'm surprised at how much functionality they pack into it for free. And it's like you don't really hit any of the limitations that would make you want to pay for the studio version, which is like the $300 software version. So
even $300, I mean, like, isn't that so much? I feel like it used to be back in the day, like if you wanted Adobe Final Cut Pro or whatever, it was like $1,000.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Now it's still expensive to buy. Like Final Cut is probably $400 or $500 or something like that, Australian. To get what you get out of it is incredible. And like the main reason I used it was that I got an ad somewhere, whether it was Twitter or Facebook, for all of these plugins, and you could get them in Premiere Pro or DaVinci or some other tool. And I was like, oh, it was $80 on sale from $500. I thought, yeah, okay, that'd be cool. But I messaged a friend of mine who, like, he does video editing for a living. And I said, I am not smart enough to use this software. It took me 10 minutes to figure out how to put a title into the timeline.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't mess with that. I usually use, like, if I'm supposed to do something quick and fast, I just use Adobe Rush anymore. If I have to, the problem is I don't want to install Adobe Creative Cloud on my machine because it's like a cancer. It just takes over the machine eventually. Oh, it's a whole thing. Yeah. And so I just don't do it anymore. I give it to somebody else to do. Hey, can you go edit this real quick for me? Or I'll literally do it on my phone. Sometimes I just do it on my phone. It's easier that way. And it's just an app at that point. So at least it's like contained, sandboxed into this one little spot in your phone. You can just uninstall it when you're done. So anyway, that's that. So yeah, Ripple's podcast, really cool. I didn't get a chance to watch all of it, but I did see that you guys had done so with Aaron. And so looking forward to watching that one. That's pretty cool. So we had talked about before we started the show, talking about a couple things today, verbs being one of them. So Eric, let's talk real quick about Eric Barnes too. So Eric Barnes has like a studio now. What is this?
Yeah.
Like he's got this sweet little co-working space studio that he set up, and he did a first, like a video podcast with Daniel Colborn, who apparently had a layover. Right close there, and it looked really super solid.
It looks good. He's got the lights there. He's got the three cameras.
Great. Yeah. So I'm curious if that's his whole setup, or if I think they said like in the co-working space, it's just like you can reserve it or something, and then
So I don't know.
It was.
I did ask him about it. There is like a podcast studio in there, but he's also rented out like an office space in there that looks really cool, which he will do. I said, because it's got like a white brick wall on one end of it. I said, don't touch that wall. Like, that's the background.
Yeah, just leave it. That's the background.
Whatever you're doing. Yep. Throw some lights at it, put a desk in front of it, and you're all set. So I think, you know, that's where he's going to do, you know, the Laravel news content that he's doing. He's got the podcast there if he's going to get people in. I think that the hard part will be getting people to him to do that. Yeah, but I like the idea of it.
Eric, if you're listening, I'm game. Next time I'm anywhere near, I'm coming to visit. I'd love to see your space. It'd be pretty cool. So, but Daniel Coolborn was on there and he talked about the origins of No Plans to Merge, like the name of the podcast, why they called it that. And he also talked about verbs a little bit. Again, it's one of those things. I keep saying this. I didn't get a chance to listen to the whole thing. I've seen enough to know kind of like what's on it, but I didn't actually listen to the whole thing. But he talked a little bit about verbs, which is this package that he's been working on for the last while. And I thought maybe we could talk a little bit on the show today. Have you looked at verbs very much? I know that he did a talk at AU, which he had a little bit of problem with like partway through. And so he didn't get through all the demo that he was hoping for. I know he did one at EU as well. And again, I didn't get to watch that one either. But have you gotten a chance to look at verbs very much or mess with it? I installed it today, just started playing with it.
Yeah, not used it, but what I saw... Like I did see his talk at Laracon AU, not in person, but I watched the recording after the fact. And I like the proposition that it gives you event sourcing without all of the complexity of event sourcing, without all of the terminology. I think is a big, like you learn it and you get past the terminology, but I think the terminology is a blocker in terms of developer experience for picking it up. But I think for the kind of work that you do and the kind of work that I do as well, like we're always trying to retrace steps of like how did we get into something or whatever, and being able to have the event stream there would certainly make things easier. But it's just there's too much stuff on in terms of building what we need to build functionality wise for the application to be able to go and figure out how we're going to retrofit stuff in there. And I know that his talk, I think at Europe was Laracon EU was around like bringing this stuff in incrementally. And there are probably places that we could do it.
Interesting.
Bit by bit. Okay. But there's just so much on that it would be, you know, a multi-month project to kind of look at where we could bring that in.
Yeah. I think it is interesting, like, because, you know, most of the applications that you're going to need something like this in are probably applications that have been around for a while. If you're just starting a brand new application, okay, sure. Maybe you need this, but I think most people who are just starting an application are sort of in rad mode. You know, they're just trying to get something out the door, right? Yeah. So they're not necessarily worried about event sourcing at this point. Maybe they should be, maybe they shouldn't, and maybe verbs actually makes it easy enough where you can kind of start with it. That's possible. I've been talking about this project that we have coming up. I suppose I can talk about it a little bit, but we do have a Greenfield project that we're going to be working on, Jordan Brill and myself, who Jordan's my boss, my buddy, that we've been working together for like the last 13 years. And so we have this product that we're going to be building, and it's really interesting because we've got this, you know, it's completely Greenfields in front of us. And so it's part of the reason I'm reading about verbs is because it would be really nice to have that traceability and to be able to just see that throughout there. The other day we were talking about on Laravel News, time zones and how to manage those. And that's another thing that would be really nice to have in there is how to, you know, handle time zones. I saw somebody on Twitter talking about this the other day, and you'd mentioned like, hey, there's a really great package for this actually that we just talked about. So verbs seems like one of those things that could be really useful if we baked it in from the beginning instead of having to retrofit it. And what you were talking about too is I think Daniel's goal here is really, like you said, to bring event sourcing to the masses, right? Yep. And they actually have a whole page in their docs called Combating Jargon, right? And the idea here is that in traditional event sourcing, there's a lot of complicated wording that can make it hard to just get started, right? So one of the things that they really tried to do in verbs was to abandon a lot of that for more simple and obvious terms, right? So they're getting away from aggregates or aggregate roots, and they're calling those now state in verbs. There's this idea of projectors, right? And so what they're doing that, instead of saying something is a projector, they're saying, well, when you call the handle method, that's where you're actually updating your database models, right? And so you have reactors. And so they're just basically taking all of these things that were sort of maybe difficult to understand or words that you hadn't heard before, and not necessarily dumbing them down, but sort of mapping them to things that as a Laravel developer, I'm already familiar with, right?
Yeah.
Even something like using, like having a method called handle. I'm very familiar with that because I know that's what I use for jobs. That's what I use for commands. It's just, it feels normal. It feels very approachable. So I love that about the package, but there, I will say, like, I've read through the first page a couple times and I'm not there yet. Of course, I will say I've only given it like 30 minutes, right? That's where I'm at. Quick start is easy. I feel like they've actually done a really good job in trying to explain it. The docs aren't only like, here's how you get started with it. It's really explaining, here is our methodology. Here is the approach that we're taking to this. And they try and teach you the ideas behind event sourcing as well as how to utilize the package. So it's pretty cool. So I am just getting started with it, but it looks like if I'm just giving you my first pass on kind of how this works, it looks like you fire events, right? Of course, event sourcing is going to be heavy on events. That event can contain some data that you're going to put on it. I will say that it's cool that they extend a thunk verb event for each event that you have. Mm-hmm. So it's not a Laravel event. It's a thunk verbs event. And there is some really cool, it's a cool API for how you can do that. So you call the event :fire, and then you can pass in as named arguments any items that you had set as public values on that particular event. So that's really cool. It feels really nice and feels very simple and clean for anybody coming behind you to look at and be like, oh, okay, I'm injecting a customer ID into this event. So there's that. But then past events, what you have is these states. So this is where this is an in-memory sort of thing. This is not in your database. So you have events, then you have states, then you have models in your database last. So that's kind of how it works. And so these states are in memory. It actually, in addition to updating state, it also is responsible. And this is where I'm getting fuzzy. The event, I think, is responsible for knowing whether or not it should fire itself. Like there's a validate on the event and then an apply on the event if it determines it should be fired. And that will update a particular piece of state. And then the state itself, I think, has a handle method that will then update your database. So I think those are the couple pieces. And Michael said this, I apologize for anybody watching this. I've got my laptop on a stand. And so anytime I touch anything, it's wobbling like crazy. So sorry about that. We'll have to put like image stabilization on this after the fact. But I think that's the way it works. Events are fired. They have their own ability to be able to pull in a state and then use that state to validate whether or not they should be fired or not. And then once they fire, the state is responsible for updating some state in memory. And then the state itself will call apply. And at that point is when you actually save it to the database. The idea here too is that you should be able to basically delete all of your models and replay the events to get back to the same state you were at before. So the models are sort of like a side effect. They're just like, it doesn't even matter. If you were to nuke your entire database, except for the events table, you should be able to replay all of your events. They should go through those states. And as long as you have the, you know, that apply that's kind of handling your database stuff, it'll rebuild your entire database as it should be. So that's pretty cool. I think that's one of the big benefits of event sourcing
is that you can reconstitute the current state of your database in the event that you need to change some behavior, you need to inject some new behavior. You know, you want to go out, how do we report on this data historically? You don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
You can add the event handler, whatever that is, and then apply that transition or that change to the model historically. And then suddenly you've got a new table that has this new information there that may not have existed. And so I think that's the power of it. Depending on whether you make that live or if you're doing that on some kind of like replica where you're doing it for reporting and things like that, you know, being able to reconstitute the world as you know it because you've got that historical data of like this model was created on this date and it was updated to, you know, this thing at this time and some status changed and some column was updated, like all of this information being stored in your events table allows you to then replay and introduce new understanding of that data retrospectively. And then you talked about the projectors and the reactors and things like that. If that, I forget the terminology, but like the thing that that is side effects, like you can go back and replay creating a model retrospectively without also triggering the event that sends an email to your customer, you know, that, okay, we're replaying the state of the database, but we're not replaying those side effect things, sending emails, text messages, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all side effects that kind of can be omitted whilst still reconstructing the state of the database. So there's definitely a lot of power to it. And I think there are certainly industries that it applies to, finance, insurance, those kinds of things where you need to kind of track the state of things happening, not just the state that they're in. But as we said at the top, you know, it's difficult to retrofit that onto existing data, but you've got to make the decision either at the start or from like some date that, you know, we are now doing this so that you can have that behavior in your application. So yeah,
it seems similar to also how you guys migrated the snowflakes, right? I mean, that was like sort of a multi-week or whatever it was migration that you guys made. It seems similar to what you would have to do if you wanted to jump onto this event sourcing bandwagon after the fact.
Yeah, you have to certainly play at it. And like the snowflakes kind of enables us to be able to do that a little bit if we wanted to. I mean, it would have worked regardless. I think the snowflakes are just useful because, especially with events, if you're firing events for, you know, a few thousand users that are actively using your system, that, you know, they're doing lots of different manipulations to the data, you're going to have a lot of events there. So the snowflakes kind of help in terms of actually being able to store an incrementing, not an incrementing, but like an ID for those events for as many as you're going to have, you know, before you run out of numbers effectively. So.
Yeah. And I think so, like if I'm thinking about it too, I'm thinking about like how could you retroactively put this into place? I guess what you could do is you could almost fire an event for each of the models that you already have in place and say something like migrating to verbs event, you know what I mean, for this particular model or whatever. And then you could fire an event that would then handle the state and the updating of the particular thing. And then that would be a state that you could, that would be an event that you could replay. The event itself would basically just house all of the values that you were migrating over to this new thing. And then if you need to replay that, it's got all the data inside of that event that was fired. And there you go. Mm-hmm. And I was wrong on that, by the way. It seems like the event itself is what handles everything. So it's like the event gets fired. And the event's life cycle sounds like it's like this. There's an authorize hook to ensure that the current user is allowed to fire an event. So the event gets fired, authorize, then validate. So validate if this event should be fired or not. And then you have, while it's in the midst of firing, you have this apply, which will update the state that we talked about before. And then you have a fired hook that happens after the apply. And then after fired, you have handle. I know, and that's a lot, but handle is where you would actually do the database updating. But it all happens on the event itself. The event is responsible for knowing how to do all of those different things. One of the reasons I'm really, really interested in reading about this too is I feel that there is a play for event sourcing and state machines do work together, right? They do. And I'm curious if Daniel's ever run into a situation where he didn't want to necessarily have to inspect the previous state of the thing in order to know what to do next, right? So in his example, he gives this idea of the user has been on a trial before. So like if I say user subscribed to a trial, right? That's the event that gets fired. In his validate step, what he's saying is grab the current state of the customer and look to see, do they currently have a subscription? Is the subscription started at null? Okay, good. And is the subscription started at more than 365 days ago? Meaning they can only do a subscription, a trial subscription once a year. Right. Mm-hmm. And if it's not, then don't allow them to do a subscription. Right. Okay. So in that case, you're having to inspect the previous state to know whether or not they can do it. Right. Whether or not they can do that thing. So I'm looking into this because I really want to see if there's any way for me to integrate state machines into this event sourcing sort of stuff or not. And I'm not educated enough on it yet to know for sure. But what I will say is that it seems, number one, super well documented. It's been really enjoyable to read the documentation. Mm-hmm. It feels like I'm talking to Daniel in a Telegram chat. Like, it's very clear and it's like littered with Daniel-isms, it feels like. And so really great job on writing up the documentation. And I'm just super excited to dig into it more. It seems like they've spent a lot of time making the API really clean. And so, yeah, excited to dig into it more and kind of see if it's something we can use in our Greenfield application for sure, but something that we could use to even replace some of this bespoke, non-standardized way of handling events that we have in some of our existing applications. I think it would be a lot cleaner and a lot more testable. So,
yeah, for sure. Yep, cool. Yep. Yeah, it'd be interesting to follow along that journey and see how you do go once you start getting into the weeds a bit more and figuring out how it actually works properly in your context.
For sure. For sure. One other thing I wanted to talk about tonight, there's a couple. I mean, one of the stupid ones that I wanted to talk about was, do you find that your kids ever take your chargers for your iPads or for your, like, so we have phone? No, they don't ever? No?
No. No.
Tell me how you do this.
Well, I mean, our kids are not really old enough. They're only allowed to have their iPad when they're sitting on the couch or at the table, right? So the iPad only ever goes from the charger to wherever they're sitting. And then when they go to bed at night, when they finish, you know, we go out, they plug it in to charge. So they don't ever make off with the chargers. I think once they get more mobile with their devices, when they're a bit older, then yeah, that may be a problem. But at the moment, no.
I think the trick is teaching them to plug it in once they're done. My kids, it's just they leave it wherever, like, they were with it last. It's like it's in one of five places, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're always dead. That's the issue. They're always dead. And so they're always like scrounging around for a charger, and they don't want to stand by where it's charging. They want to go sit somewhere.
Yeah,
exactly. And so it's like, then they can't find a charger, and so they just go find one. And the mm-hmm. place where they find one, where they know they're always going to find one, is like next to my bedstand. It's like, there's a charger. I'll use dad's. And I'm like, what the world? Yeah. So I'm like, there's got to be a product out there on the market that allows me to lock my charger to like the wall. And then I was reading on that, and some people were like, if you can't tell your kids to not take your charger and they don't, and they, you know, and they listen to you, then you've probably got bigger problems. Like, maybe that's true. Maybe that's true. Maybe the issue is not my kids. Maybe it's that I need to just, you know, explain to them how to respect people's property. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, no, our kids are pretty good with them in that they will generally plug them in. Like when Eli leaves for school in the morning, he will plug it in. Like if they don't, then either Rhea or I will plug them in, because nothing worse than them coming home and not being able to use the iPad mm-hmm. because it's gone flat.
Indeed.
They've left it. So yeah, either the kids or, you know, as a last resort, Rhea and I, we will plug it in to make sure that it is charged. Like when they run out, and it's like, all right, well, that clearly means you've been using the iPad for too long, so go and find something else to do for a while.
Sure.
But not having too many issues otherwise with it. Eli's generally very good. It's like, okay, yesterday he came home from school and he goes, can I have the iPad? I said, you can have the iPad until mum comes home with Liv from childcare. Okay, no worries. And as soon as the front door opened, he turned the iPad off. And then I go out there and he's crying. I said, what's wrong, bud? Rhea went out there and went, what's wrong? And he goes, Dad said I had to turn the iPad off when you came home. I'm like, yeah, I appreciate that you did it though, even though you're upset about
good
it.
Good man.
Like, just try and get away with it. So he's generally pretty good. They're pretty good with their limits. And when they're told, you know, you can do it for some period of time, we put the oven timer on so that it's like when that goes off, it's time to turn the iPad off.
Yeah, for sure. Our kids know it's like there's a 15-minute timer typically, like before, if somebody else is waiting, they know they have to set a timer. And so it's always a 15-minute timer. So Siri is constantly setting 15-minute timers around our house. And, you know, with four kids and like an iPad charged at a time, it's typically getting passed around quite a bit.
Yeah.
And so, fun times. Hey, one of the other things I was going to ask you about is if you've had the chance to upgrade anything to Laravel 11 yet.
No. It's on my to-do list to do. I did actually run through the Laravel 11 like alpha shift. Jamak and jumped on a on a Zoom call and went through it just to see, like, because we've got a hoofer of an app which took like 30 minutes to run the shift, which helped him kind of get into the optimization of the shift. So he's got it down to like 3 minutes or something. Like, it runs as quick as the previous ones, but it's doing a lot of stuff. And because of the reflection and the introspection and things like that, that it has to do to kind of figure out what it can and can't remove and what it has to change. And like, he's done a tremendous job to get it to run as quickly.
Oh, you're not kidding. Yeah, as quickly as it does and as insanely insightful as it is.
Yeah. So I've got a task to do it at some point. So we've got a PHP 8.3 upgrade and a Laravel 11 upgrade, but there's other stuff on at the moment. So nothing at this stage. Probably the Laracon website, when that's ready, I'll bump that to Laravel 11, but other than that, not really.
Yeah.
You've got a plethora of apps. I'm sure you've moved.
We
some
do.
Of them
oh my list. Word. We have a bunch. We have a bunch of apps. And so I think we've got four of our apps upgraded to Laravel 11 now. And I thought it would be helpful maybe just to talk about some of the gotchas that we've found in upgrading that you might want to be aware of. And so my goal really is to have every one of our applications feel like it started on Laravel 11. Right. And JMac has like this Laravel fixer that will go through after the fact and say, this looks like it's not exactly set up like the most recent version is. And so you might want to consider updating this. We're not running that on these applications. We're just doing the shift. But that's my hope, is that like, I want somebody who's coming into this to be able to look at the documentation for Laravel 11, look at our application and be like, yeah, everything should be in the right spot. Like, I'm looking to find it where I would expect it to be based on the documentation, right? And so we've probably heard of the fact that the configs are drastically slimmed down. And so the only thing that the shift, if you're using Laravel shift, which I'm assuming at this point you're using Laravel shift, if you'd be ill-advised not to, I guess is what I would say. Shift does a ton of work on the back end. And I will say, I agree with JMac that this is the most comprehensive shift he's ever written. It was wild how much of the stuff it picked up and how good of a job it did diffing our configs and keeping the stuff that needed to be kept and ditching the stuff that needed to be deleted. It was amazing. And so I will say that by default, the Laravel shift, when it runs, will delete most of your configs. If not, I mean, all but like just a very few of them. And so the ones that we had sticking around were database.php sometimes, although not often. Like, even that, it seemed like for the most part, you could get away with deleting it and just changing a couple small things in your PHP unit.xml or in your ENV that's in production. You can typically get away with just deleting that database.php file altogether and just being a little more careful with your ENV values. But would highly suggest that if you're shifting, try and get rid of all of the configs that is possible for you to do. If you think of it like a golf challenge, right? Code golf, where like you try and get something done in the fewest amount of lines. That's how I'm approaching it. Like, I want to get rid of every config that's possible. So when I did the shift, it's like, oh, the time zone was kept. Ditching that, not doing that. Like, I'll put in the env.example. I'll go update it over there. No big deal. In the database.php, there was this thing that does timestamp on migrations. It says false. And it was like, if you haven't squashed your migrations, it's possible that vendor packages that publish migrations could republish with a different timestamp. And so we have to keep this in there. I'm like, nope, squashing the migrations, getting rid of that. Database.php is gone. All right, what else? Right. And so then there's like, queue or broadcasting or horizon or whatever that's in there. And so you just kind of go through and figure out what are the things that I need to change in order to make this the most default it can and get it down to the smallest number of configs possible. And when you do, it feels freaking awesome because you got like two configs left. And you know that the next time you have to shift something, it's going to be no big deal at all. Now, what I will say is that you need to have github.com/Laravel/Laravel on speed dial because you're going to be referencing those configs a lot. It's not necessarily easy to get to those default configs from within your code editor, for me necessarily, because mine are like in an ignore folder, my vendor, it doesn't index all my vendor folders, right? Yeah. It would take forever to do that. And so if I search for, logging.php, for example, it doesn't pull up because it's not in my project anymore. Or if I do have a logging.php, it's only got one option left in it. And I want to compare it to the default options and see what's in there. So you need to really have that repo ready, available to go look at and reference so that you can make the changes to pull it back into line with the defaults so you can get rid of it. So that's one thing I found really helpful.
Tinkerwell. Tinkerwell config, like config logging, and it will spit everything out.
Great idea.
I think that is like the downside of the change to having the slimmer configurations is that the configurations themselves are less discoverable.
Yeah, it's for sure it is.
And like there were always bits and pieces in there. The S3 configuration, the ability to pass things into database config and things like that, where they just weren't obvious unless you went source diving. So I think that is probably a bit of a knock on it. I get it from the perspective of, you know, it slims down the skeleton and there's nothing in there that doesn't have to be there for your application to run. Like everything will keep running as it did before. I don't buy necessarily that it's harder for newcomers to the framework because you never go and look in those config files. You never go and change them anyway. But from a perspective of discoverability, I think it is a bit trickier than what it was. Like you can't just open the file and, as you say, see what was there and figure out what you need to change. So, there's a balance. I think on the whole, what we have now is good. It's just discoverability is a bit more lacking as a result.
It's true. And it's sort of like a trade-off, right? It's like, what's more important to you? Is the discoverability of the configuration options more important, or is the upgradability of the application more important?
And for how often you're going to change them, like it's not that big a deal to go and look at the vendor file to figure out like what's in there and what you need to set.
Typically, the only time you're going to go change them is if you're reading the documentation and it tells you to do so. Right. Mm-hmm. Like if it tells you, oh, if you want this option, go change it here. But most of those are also going to be available to be changed through ENV values. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like it's just not all that often that you need to change something in a config value that's not also being set by an ENV value. Yeah. Like,
and so there's an argument to be made about like the ENV should, in like very aggressive air quotes, only be for things that change from environment to environment.
Yes.
Secrets, URLs, like things like that. So making the entire application environment configurable doesn't make sense from that point of view. But again, I don't Agreed. Think it's that big a deal. You know, it's using the .env file is a misappropriation of that functionality anyway. You know, broadly speaking, you're not quote unquote supposed to put things into a .env file in production. You're supposed to inject environment variables, but the practicality of doing so doesn't make sense, you know, to figure out how to put those things into Nginx so that Nginx injects the environment variables or putting them into a Docker container, however you're shipping things to production. Like that just doesn't make sense. And the argument that, you know, if someone gets your .env file, it's insecure. Like everything gets cached down into a flat PHP file anyway in production typically. Mm-hmm. You've got your, you know, artisan optimize or config cache. All of those things, whether in the .env file or they're in the compiled, you know, bootstrap cache, config.php, they're still in a file. And if you can get to .env, you can get to bootstrap cache config. So I think the security implications of that are not really a concern either, practically speaking.
Yeah, I will say one thing that bit me is that when you upgrade to Laravel 11, the default DB connection is now set to SQLite. So heads up on that, because that is something that I didn't necessarily have set in the ENV because I didn't have to. Like the ENV was always just set to MySQL by default, so I didn't set the DB connection. And so in production, when I was going to deploy these Laravel 11 apps, it'd be like migrating SQLite. And it was like, what the heck? What are you doing? Uh-oh. And it was like, I don't want to use SQLite. And so I had to make sure that I put DB connection in each of those. So that's one big heads up too. Like if you don't have DB connection specified, you're going to have to specify that in your ENV or you're going to have to in your database.php config, you're going to have to spell it out that it's supposed to be MySQL by default.
I think if you Laravel new an application, it will ask you what database connection you want to use.
It will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It will default to SQLite, but you can specify MySQL. And like I will continue to use MySQL just because it's the only real concern in terms of like doing something in in local development that could potentially be different in production. There are some peculiarities around the way that
there are
SQLite works that are different enough to MySQL that you don't want to be catching them in production.
Correct.
At the very least, if you're going to use SQLite locally, you should be using MySQL in CI, in GitHub Actions, or whatever you're using.
Yep.
If you're also using MySQL in production, like at the very least, catch those things before you get them into prod.
It is true. Yeah.
I think the general sentiment is use SQLite as long as you can use SQLite, and until you need some SQL specific, whether it's Postgres or MySQL specific functionality, the Laravel grammar that kind of maps all of the different database engines, connection types, is pretty robust at this point, where you're not going to run into too many issues unless you're using features specific to a database connection type.
Yeah, I will say that we actually had to switch over to MySQL for some of our testing stuff and realized that there was a bunch of tests failing using MySQL that were not failing when we were using SQLite. And that was a bit of a scary moment. It was like, whoa, what in the world? Like, have we just been having false passing tests? And we were. I mean, that is exactly what was happening. Now, they were actually working, but the tests themselves were like not checking correctly the stuff that they were supposed to check just because it was just running SQLite instead of MySQL. So
yeah,
I agree with that. I think that if you're using... It is very much. So anyway, heads up on that. The other thing then so the config is definitely much different. The other thing that's different then is that a lot of the service providers, I feel like you're encouraged to get rid of them as much as possible. There is not, I think there's three service providers in Laravel/Laravel. Mm-hmm. There's the app service provider. No, there's one. There's the app service provider. That's it. And the default, there is one service provider. That is all. And in that app service provider, you're just kind of doing a couple things, not a whole lot. And then most of the things that you're doing in all of your other service providers previously, like your event service provider, you're now encouraged to do in your app service provider. So It's sort of like saying, yeah, I know you had an event service provider before, and maybe that registered some listeners and some subscribers and all that stuff. No, just do that in your apps. Just do that in your app service provider. You know, don't necessarily name it. I mean, give it a private method if you want to. That's fine.
Sure.
But just do it in your app service provider. And so you have one place to look for all of the different things that are getting done, and that's fine. It is a shift, I will say. It is a shift in thinking, but it's not too bad. It's not too bad. And the other thing about it is Laravel has embraced this idea of auto discovery for a while now with listeners and things like that. Previously in your event service provider, you would manually register or manually do those. Or like, you know, it used to be like in the console kernel, you used to register your commands. It just auto discovery, right? So most of the things that you used to have to register through the service providers are just done automatically for you. As long as they're in the default location, they get registered, no big deal. So embrace that like new process and that new methodology, and just try and get down to the service providers that you have to have. Try and get some of those things out of that event service provider. Utilize that auto registration stuff and get down to just the app service provider. Not only that, but you know, make that a task that you at least attempt to embrace, right? Try to do that thing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think typically the only thing that we really like, we do some auth stuff in like the auth service provider, and we have for macros, like we have a stringable service provider, and we have something else that we macro, like the collection service provider, I think, and we put macros that we are reusing into those just because it makes it easier to go, okay, where are these macros coming from? And like we can go to the collection service provider, or we can go to the stringable service provider, and we know that the macro, like we've got one that takes a string input and then does some transformation for phone numbers to do formatting and to make sure that like we have got a valid phone number and that, you know, it's in the correct shape and things like that. So when we're presenting it, we can do string of, you know, dollar model arrow mobile number arrow to mobile number, and it will give us a thing that is presented as we would expect to see a mobile number. So those kinds of things we tuck into specific providers. But other than that, like other than situations where you're doing container bindings, you know, these things are typically for packages, really. the providers that they can bind things to the container and they can do some kind of setup in that way.
Just a couple of lines. I mean, like some of these things, it's just not that there's not a whole lot.
You're not creating a whole new provider for one thing. And in the app service provider. And if you need to extract, because you've got, you know, two or three similar things, put it, as you say, into a private method. And if that starts to balloon, then maybe consider whether you need to create a specific provider for that set of functionality.
Yep, agreed. Here's the one other thing I'll say about service providers. And this goes along with kind of the shift over to also having the rest of your configuration that used to get done in the service providers being done in bootstrap/app.php. Mm-hmm. So most of the things that used to happen in the service providers are going to be handled inside of there. And that is a big change as well. But again, after doing it, I found out that like you actually don't need that much configuration. There usually is only a couple things, and that file, having it all in one spot, actually feels pretty good instead of having it mm-hmm. kind of in five or six different places.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah. So in that bootstrap/app.php, you can do something like arrow with providers, and you can list your providers in there. However, you shouldn't. And I talked to both JMac and Taylor on this one. The way that it works right now, if you use PHP Artisan make provider or something like that, I think is what it is, it will put that service provider inside of bootstrap/providers.php. It's just an array of service providers that you have there. And that's where it puts it by default. It's sort of like, you can think of it as like it's auto registering it there, mm-hmm. right? And it's it'll cache that and those providers then get loaded up. So you can kind of do it in either. But when I talked to Taylor, he was like, I mean, I would literally never use with providers. You can think of as providers.php as basically being called, as basically calling with providers. He's like, but I would never, you know, you certainly shouldn't do it in both places. Just pick one. And if it was me, I would put it in providers.php. So that's what we've done. We just put it all in providers.php. If you need to register your own service providers, do it over there. It's one place that you can just see all the providers that are being registered with the application. And there you go. The other items that you'll see in that bootstrap/app.php that you'll want to pay attention to are some of the middleware items. In sort of the with middleware, you will handle anything like registering like middleware aliases that that you might have had previously. Let me think about it. There was one other thing that I wanted to say about that, but I don't remember what it was. Not sure. It doesn't matter. So that's middleware. Make sure you have your aliases registered in there, which again, Shift will do for you, which is really freaking awesome. And then the other thing that I noticed that was a bit problematic for us is instead of having a handler.php now, where you used to handle all your different exceptions that bubble up to the top, you don't have that anymore. Not by default anyway. The handler.php does not get called anymore like that. You can do it if you want to. And that app, that bootstrap/app.php will do it for you if you want. You can basically say, register to this handler.php is what should handle all the exceptions. Or what you can do is any of the custom handling that you were doing inside of there, you can do inside of this fluent with exceptions method. And it will just pass you the exception, and then you can do whatever you want to do in there. And so what I found is that we had basically just left handler.php as it was from like Laravel 7. I mean, like it's just been like that forever. We haven't ever needed to update it. But since they were removing it, we had to go in and look and see what it was and what were we doing in there. And again, I found that for applications that have been around for 5-6 years, the configuration came down to like 6 lines, most of it. You know, it did not need its own whole file to do all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But if you have an application that's lived a long time, that handler.php file might end up being sort of large and hairy, and you might need to pull it over. You'll just have to do a little bit of a refactor on that. So I think that's it. The routing stuff is a little bit different as well, but that's going to be covered in the docs, and it's a little bit too code heavy to talk about on the podcast. But I think those are the only things I really have that were big changes. It's going to be something you're going to have to intentionally embrace. That's what I will say. It is not a small change. I don't think you can make it a small change. You can make it something where like Shift will just handle kind of bringing over all your old stuff and making it work. It'll do that. I would advise to not do that though. I would advise to do the extra work, embrace that change, and make it feel like a Laravel 11 application. It's just going to take a little bit more work to do so. So if you have any questions, you know, reach out to JMac, reach out to myself, reach out to, you know, somebody on the Laravel team. We're all happy to help. But there's just a couple little things that might bite you. And if you have some problems, like, feel free to reach out and chat. I'd love to help.
Cool. Perfect.
We are at time, my friend.
I think so.
We are at time. All right. What was this episode again?
153.
Thanks, folks, for hanging out with us. You can find show notes for this episode at northmeetsouth.audio/153. Check us out on Twitter at Michael Jordan, at Jacob Bennett, or at North South Audio. And if you like the podcast, rate it up in your podcast of choice. 5 stars would be amazing. Look at that. Outro, cue the music. Thank you, Mr. Durinda. A consummate professional. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Bye, everyone.